8 billion people and growing. That's how many of us are on this planet. Each individual is part of a complex network of people, communities, and economies. At times, we may not feel close to one another due to political difference, war, a fight for resources. But we are a we society, whether we like it or not, and the list of how interconnected we are is endless. And in this podcast series, we're here to tell you about the thousands of ways the social sciences can help us understand and enhance this complicated human network. I'm Will Hutton. I'm a journalist, author, and an economist. I'm also the president of the Academy of Social Sciences, the organization behind this podcast series. I see firsthand how social science is providing us with ideas to shape the world we live and change our society for the better. From sport policy, city planning, to the boardroom, in every high office you will find a social scientist. Throughout this series, we'll be speaking to some of the top social scientists in the country to hear their fixes and their ideas to shape the world we live. We are a society of we, and without innovation and new ideas, there's a chance of stagnation, or worse, a slide into decline. Welcome to the We Society podcast. How we are housed impacts on us all. But from top to bottom, housing is in crisis. House prices are more than 8 times average incomes. Renters and first-time buyers alike spend as much as 40% of their take-home pay on rent or their mortgage. People defer starting a family or are unable to move to a part of the country where there's a job. It's menacing our very civilization. Those at the sharpest end of the crisis are rough sleepers. During the COVID lockdown, the government introduced a Everyone In scheme, whereby every rough sleeper in the UK was offered hotel accommodation. A reported 37,000 were helped under the scheme, and yet rough sleeping has increased by 26% in the last year. What's happening behind the policies and the numbers? We're lucky at the We Society to have one of the foremost experts in homelessness and housing policy with us today. Polly Neat is the CEO of Shelter, the housing charity. Before that, she headed Women's Aid, and a while before that, she was a journalist who wrote for The New Statesman and The Guardian. Polly, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
Now, when you got the invitation to join the We Society podcast, and you heard the words We Society, of course, I'm sure you're an avid listener, but what was your first thought when you heard this title, The We Society?
I love that title, actually, because it implies our responsibilities towards each other to me. That's what it says to me, that we all have a responsibility to the society we live in, to make it better. And I suppose that's what the name, the We Society, says to me. So I was, and I was pretty flattered to be invited as well.
Oh, you're flattered. Come on, we need to talk housing policy, and who better than you, really? I mean, Shelter is a huge organisation, been so influential over the last kind of 40, 50 years in this space. But I want to start off, we're going to do homelessness, we're going to do rough sleeping, but I want to start off with, most people listening to this programme won't be rough sleeping.
There'll be
people struggling with their rent or with their mortgage. And why are house prices so damn high in relation to income? And what can be done about it? I mean, I can introduce you to people who say it's a threat to our civilisation.
Yeah, well, I really agree it's a threat to our civilization. And one of the challenges we have at Shelter, actually, is to try to raise housing in public awareness to the level of crisis that people see when they look at the NHS, for example. I mean, the housing crisis, I would argue, is worse than the crisis we have in the NHS. We still have an NHS. We actually don't have social housing. So if you become homeless in this country, there's nothing there for you. And it absolutely does threaten our civilization. If you don't have a safe home, you don't have the means to build a decent life. It's as simple as that. So
when you say we don't have social housing, I mean, there are council houses.
Yes.
I mean, and there are housing associations. There is a stock of social housing. It's about what? Certainly a quarter of our housing stock, maybe a third.
Yes. Of course, we do.
When you say that, what do you mean?
What I mean by that is that for people newly needing social housing, we don't have social housing, pretty much. So there are people living in social housing, and that's vitally important. But we're actually going backwards every year in terms of delivering new social homes. And so what that means is that when people can no longer afford housing, which increasingly is happening, particularly in private renting, where rents are becoming more and more unaffordable by the week almost, when people can no longer afford their rent and they become homeless, it's very, very unlikely that they're going to get a social home. And there's 1.2 million people on the waiting list for social housing. And of those people, well over a quarter of a million are actually homeless and in temporary accommodation. And the rest of them are in very, very unstable housing situations. Their housing is unaffordable. Otherwise, they wouldn't be on that waiting list. So when I say we don't have social housing, what I mean is we don't have social housing to offer people who get into the situation where a social home is what they need.
In the 1910s, in the 1920s, in the 1930s, one of the things that really radicalised politicians of right and left was housing.
Right.
Clem Attlee arrived in to work in the East End of London from Oxford, not really a socialist or leaning left, but became a man of the left, witnessing slums and slum life firsthand. Harold Macmillan got elected as MP for Stocks in 1924. One of his first speeches in the House of Commons was, housing is not a socialist issue, it's not a conservative issue, it's a matter of common humanity. And these men and women at the time, witnessing slums and witnessing the lives lived in slums, made housing almost the number one issue in their kind of political perspective. Can we imagine that happening in Britain in the 2020s, 2030s?
Well, the biggest problem I think we face at the moment is that for many years now, we've had a Conservative government that does not see housing as a Conservative issue, or certainly doesn't see investing in social housing as something that a Conservative government does. Whereas, as you've rightly just said, actually the biggest house building Prime Minister was Macmillan. So there's absolutely no reason why a Conservative government can't see this as the answer. And there are many Conservative MPs, to be fair, who agree with that. But social housing has almost become a kind of toxic issue, I think, for Conservatives in power, and that has been a big contributor. I have to say, Tony Blair wasn't noted for his investment in social housing either. So, you know, we're talking about decades of failure by successive governments. But a big problem we have right now is the lack of political will on housing. And I would say that is a big problem. That is something that is at the heart of the Conservative governments that we've had for the last, since 2010.
There was an exchange that Nick Clegg reported with George Osborne and David Cameron,
yes,
when he was urging kind of we need to build more social housing, in fairness to the Liberal Democrats in the coalition government. And the retort was, but they all vote Labour. Why would you do that?
Yes.
Your response?
Well, I think with the red wall seats, I think the government are rapidly learning that many people in social housing don't vote Labour or might not necessarily vote Labour if they thought the government was interested in their day-to-day lives. And, you know, now we've got Brexit out of the way, I would say, you know, there absolutely cannot be any levelling up without proper investment in people's housing. And so I think the government is learning that. But actually, you know, this is kind of what I mean, that there's this, it's like an axiom for the Conservatives that, you know, they can only be about home ownership. They can't be about housing for ordinary people or people on low incomes. But actually, A, that's comparatively recent Conservative philosophy. And B, actually, one of the main problems about home ownership and why it's declining is people simply cannot afford the upfront investment that's needed to buy a home. And that's partly because rents in private renting are so high, more than half of private renters have no savings whatsoever. So these aren't people on the cusp of home ownership. If rents were lower and they were pegged to local incomes, i.e. social homes, people would be much more able to save and ultimately get themselves on the property ladder.
One of the problems, though, is that you know, private landlords have to buy these properties. They've got to, they have to pay the going price, and the going price is astonishingly high.
Yes.
And consequently, you know, if they're going to get a kind of a, any kind of income that's comparable to what they might get from investing in, say, government bonds, it needs to be at the current levels, especially if they've got to repair these houses or something. I mean, it's not. Wow.
I mean,
we're in a kind of trap where kind of land prices are so high and house and flat prices are so high that, you know, we have to find a way of deflating that entire bubble, don't we?
Yeah. So land values is a really key point, which I'll kind of return to. But I think what you're talking about is the impact of a society in which property is viewed as an investment primarily, rather than primarily a home. So what happens is we have a huge amount of vested interest in house prices increasing. And if you look at people who've done very well out of house price increases, a lot of them, you know, there's a huge vested interest there in not seeing house prices fall, particularly because a lot of people now don't have great pensions. People see the property they own as their investment in their future. And the whole system is geared towards property being an asset which appreciates over time for the people lucky enough to have it. Of course, the side effect of that is, for one thing, it pushes rents up. And of course, for landlords, as their mortgage goes up, this is part of what's happening at the moment with interest rates, as landlords' mortgages go up, of course, they put their rents up. That no one's blaming them for that. But the impact of that on tenants, of course, is that they can no longer afford their rent. And if you can't afford your rent, ultimately you'll be evicted. And then you end up on that social housing waiting list that I was talking about before.
I mean, this is your life. You know, every day you're working at it. I mean, and you see the crisis in the raw. I mean, you see
absolutely
the consequence of sleeping rough, and you see homelessness in the raw and what it means. But I mean, if I made you kind of, you know, prime minister for a week, you know, what levers would you pull to kind of deflate house prices, deflate land prices?
Probably the first thing I would do, which, to be fair, I think there is a level of understanding in the government, particularly, I think Michael Gove absolutely gets this, there's a need to get rid of what's called hope value, which is basically means that when you, as a landowner, when you sell a piece of land, the price of that piece of land is based on its highest potential development value. So if it was developed into luxury flats, how much would that land be worth, basically? And what that does is then inflate land prices right from the start, and it encourages developers to just bank land and not build it out. They're in no hurry to do it because they have such a huge asset just in the land. And it means that when the land is developed, it then becomes, for the developer, very difficult to afford to build lower cost housing on it. So it encourages land banking, and it also encourages the development of luxury buildings, for which actually there isn't really a market now. Interestingly, this issue about land values completely defeats the government's building targets. So historically, we've never built anywhere near 250,000, 300,000 new homes a year.
We did in the 50s.
Without a significant number of them being social housing.
Yeah, in the 1950s, that was
all. It's never been possible to, yes, it's never been possible to achieve those numbers solely for, you know, housing for people to buy. It's always included a significant amount of social homes. So the first thing I would do, I think, if I was Prime Minister for a week, I'd do loads of things, but in relation specifically to this issue, I would definitely change hope value. So that would involve primary legislation. The other thing I would do, which is pretty straightforward as well, is reform the government's Orwellian-named affordable housing programme, which doesn't build affordable housing. And there's a significant investment in that programme, which at the moment, for some of the reasons I've outlined and others, isn't delivering social homes. So what I would do is reform that programme, reform the definition of affordable that is used in order to make sure that I personally think all that investment in the affordable housing programme should be going into social housing, because that's where the crisis is. The crisis that we have, the real human crisis that you were talking about, that undermines the fabric of our society and the ability of citizens to lead a good life, that crisis is the crisis in social homes. It's not the home ownership crisis.
What about right to buy?
Well, so, right to buy's big problem was that it prevented, the legislation prevents councils from using the receipts from right to buy to build replacement social homes. So the homes that have been sold off under right to buy haven't been replaced. Also, a significant number of them have gone into the buy-to-let market. So they're actually now being...
That's amazing, isn't it? I mean, you go to parts of all around the country. I mean, I'm of an age where a lot of my kind of network are downsizing, and to release equity to help their children on the house price ladder, and then buy somewhere smaller themselves, and they're moving into former council houses.
Yeah, completely.
It's unbelievable. And you also have the buy-to-let, where actually, a lot of former council houses are now kind of extravagant rents to private, to people doing kind of Airbnb and all the rest of it. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, ordinary private landlords.
It wouldn't be acceptable, but it would be more palatable if at the same time there'd been a new build programme from the proceeds of selling these council houses.
Yeah.
So at least you could say, we've got some absolutely fantastic housing that's going to be only 10, 20 years old. And that kind of sweetens the pill. But we haven't got that.
No, we haven't. And I think that's part of this, I think, false dichotomy that governments since the early 80s, I think, have been absolutely enthralled to, which is that somehow home ownership and social housing are kind of two opposing policies. You can only pursue one of those two policies, when actually, of course, if you look at housing across society, you have to have both of those. Of course, you do need to consider the fact that people want to own their own home. You also have to make sure that people who need to rent, who are on low incomes, are able to rent a decent home. And those two things, not only should they not be considered in opposition to each other, they need to be considered as two sides of the same coin in policy terms. It's really interested me, as you said in your intro, I used to be chief executive of Women's Aid, and this is going to be relevant in a minute. When I was relating with to Conservative ministers as chief executive of Women's Aid, there was no assumption about my own personal political views made there. That was a really straightforward relationship between a CEO of a major charity and a Secretary of State at that time, Theresa May, actually, in the Home Office. And that was a really easy relationship. As soon as I was chief executive of Shelter, it shows how politicised housing has become, because there was immediately a sense from Conservative ministers, even though I was the same person, that suddenly they were looking at a kind of political foe and somebody who was completely against home ownership by virtue of arguing for social homes. So that kind of it's an incredibly polarised subject, housing. And we have to address that because, we've got to understand that the housing crisis impacts people of all kinds and people of, different income levels and different political persuasions. And just like health, it's something that you have to see in the round. You can't just look at one end of it. And we've been really struggling, I think, with successive governments who've only looked at a small part of housing and completely ignored or misunderstood the rest of it.
But as I was saying earlier, interwar politicians and politicians in the first 20 years after the Second World War kind of understood this. I mean, and we now have, in the introduction, I think it's very difficult to tell a story about the falling birth rate without discussing why so many couples defer having a child into their 30s. and you know they delay because they can't buy a house to have to bring their sons and daughters up in.
Not only that, they can't afford to rent a house big enough either. So if you're on a low income, it is extremely difficult to rent a decent family home, again, because of the lack of social homes. So this is affecting, as I say, this is not only affecting potential home buyers, it's affecting everybody, this issue that it's increasingly unaffordable to find somewhere where decent to live. And what's happening as well is that people who have enough money to buy a property are moving into other areas. So people are buying homes in places that, you know, traditionally they wouldn't have lived for class reasons or whatever. And that's driving up unaffordability everywhere. And so at the end of the day, of course, like all these things, the people worst impacted are the people on the lowest incomes.
Just a quick break in the conversation to tell you more about the organisation behind the We Society podcast. We champion the social sciences and highlight the important role academics and practitioners have in all sectors of our society, whether that's business, health, government, education. The list is endless. It currently feels like the world's in a state of flux as we grapple with the ongoing war in Ukraine, the cost of living crisis, spiralling energy costs, climate change. The social sciences have a vital role to play in improving lives, and this podcast brings you the best ideas to shape the way we live. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read upon our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. You can follow us on Twitter at @AcadSocSciences and tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. Now, let's talk about rough sleeping. I mean, it's not yet at kind of epidemic proportions, but it's the needle's getting quite close. I mean, you can't... already, most city centres, you'll find tents, bivouacs, the smell of urine, people looking pretty unhappy, begging on the railway and on the underground is growing as people insist that they need this money to find somewhere to stay the night. Just give me a sense. I mean, this is one of your kind of frontline things at Shelter. Just give listeners a sense of where you think we're at, why it's growing, what can be done.
So I think at the end of the day, rough sleeping is growing because homelessness is growing, and the most desperate, impoverished end of homelessness will lead people into rough sleeping, and the trauma of homelessness will lead people into rough sleeping. But, you know, on any given night, there are about 5,000, roughly, people sleeping rough. There are 250,000 people homeless and in hostels, temporary accommodation, B&Bs, in appalling circumstances, including about 125,000 children. So we do need to see homelessness in its totality. And, you know, in order to tackle rough sleeping, ultimately we have to tackle wider homelessness, which is about the housing crisis that we've just been discussing. And, you know, by the time somebody is sleeping rough, the experiences and the trauma that that person will have been through means that their situation is much more complicated. And you referred to everyone in the policy during COVID, which on one level was kind of great. Obviously, much better for people to be in hotels than to be on the street. But it wasn't a solution to rough sleeping. It was an emergency solution to a pandemic. It was never going to be the answer to rough sleeping because, you know, you put people in hotel rooms and then people want their hotels back eventually.
I'm just trying to empathise what it must be like if you are kind of without a home, you know, where you, you know, yeah, you know, washing,
well, let me just
bathing,
give you a
clothing,
statistic.
Food. Much of the stuff one takes for granted.
It's totally unlivable. And actually, you know, the average age of death of somebody sleeping, of a man sleeping rough, is 47. Yeah. And for a woman, it's 43. It's actually the only group in the population where women die younger than men do. And that just gives you an illustration, I think, very starkly, of how dangerous rough sleeping is. And all forms of homelessness are trauma. And I'm using that word advisedly, not in a colloquial sense, but in the true sense of that, you know, there's a severe damage to people's mental health involved in being homeless. And same thing with families in bed and breakfast. You know, those parents and children, particularly during the pandemic, but even now, that is a traumatic and life-impacting experience for people. And it will have effects subsequently in people's lives, particularly, you know, if you're a child and you spend 5 years of your early childhood living in one room in a bed and breakfast that's wall-to-wall beds, where you've got a communal kitchen at one end of the corridor, a communal bathroom at the other end of the corridor. There's no, you know, you're laying the bed for your meals. There's absolutely no room. I've met a girl who was doing her GCSEs. The only place she could revise was sitting on the toilet. You know, I've met a mum who, her room in a B&B was literally wall-to-wall beds. She had no room to put her baby down to learn to crawl. And she was now being told the baby was failing to thrive and could be taken into care. So these are the daily experiences of people, of families who are absolutely hidden, who are homeless. And, you know, that is a really traumatic. If you're a child and you spend your childhood in that situation, those are years you never get back. You don't get your childhood back. And the impact of that can last the whole of somebody's life. So we really are in a situation now where homelessness, including rough sleeping, you said rough sleeping is not at epidemic proportions. I would say,
I'm just saying the needle was,
the totality of homelessness is at epidemic proportions.
That's what I'm trying to get at. But there's also, if it doubles again, it will be an epidemic.
Well, you know, I would say well over 250,000 people homeless. That's
an epidemic.
An epidemic. That is massive.
Yeah, that's huge.
And it's impacting, and the number of children involved, I would say, you know, it's
astonishing. You said half of them were children. You said half.
About 125,000 children are homeless.
But that's not every night, is it? Or is that every night?
Yes,
You're saying 5,000 a night.
I'm talking about 5,000 rough sleepers a night, roughly.
Yeah.
Children don't sleep rough. Well, some actually do. There are families that sleep on buses and in all-night restaurants, for example. But in general, a local authority has to find a roof to put over a child's head. They can't allow a child to be sleeping rough if they know about them. So that's why I'm talking about people in temporary accommodation being the kind of vast majority of people who are homeless.
I find it hard to kind of, one sense of offence about this is vast. I mean, how can we have allowed ourselves to get to this position? I mean, one of the other areas that I find astonishing is, you know, the taxation of property. I mean, council tax is risible. There hasn't been a revaluation of residential property values since 1991. The council tax on a 10, 20 or 30 million pound property is only fractionally higher than an average property. I mean, it's amazing because it's all capped.
We have a completely dysfunctional relationship with property as a country, I think. And, you know, I was talking earlier about viewing property as primarily as an investment rather than for residential property, a home. And it's about enabling people to make that investment where they can and then hang on to it and pass it on to their children. That's the policy aim, rather than enabling as many people as possible to have a safe home. And of course, one understands there'll be a spectrum of that. And some people will be able to afford a much larger and more lovely home than others, obviously. But the aim of policy needs to be to enable people to have a home rather than, as I say, to enable a small number of people to have an investment and for that investment to appreciate as much as possible.
Yeah. I mean, just some of the great thinkers, you know, the last century, I think Richard Tawney, you know, he was going to make a distinction, he says, between property that has a function. I mean, the function of property is to provide, you know, homes. I mean, that's what, or, you know, you can think of property as acquisitive, you know, it's to kind of enrich you.
Exactly.
So it's a fundamental distinction.
Exactly.
And again, these distinctions were made 100 years ago and hardly, you know, they're kind of fallen out of our language, really, out of our discourse.
Yeah. And that's the thing that I find the most difficult, actually, and the most worrying. You know, we've got a general election coming up. What would be fantastic is to see housing as one of the kind of top three issues that drives that general election. Well, that's our job at Shelter, to put it up there if we possibly can. But it's a tall order because people just don't understand, I think, fundamentally, people don't understand that this is an emergency that has a solution. There are answers.
Well, there are multiple answers, aren't there? You've got to say on tax, you were just saying on planning, you were just saying on right to buy, you've got to release land so that more can be built in it.
Yeah.
I would argue...
It's all doable.
It's all doable. You've also got to...
It's all doable, but I also think people get really bogged down in the complexity of housing because I don't think we have a national narrative about the simplicity of it. So if you look at the NHS, for example, people feel very passionately about the existence of the NHS. Now, that's really complex. There's loads of policy issues, as I'm sure you, I don't need to tell you, there's loads of policy issues about how we maintain the NHS, whether we can afford it, how we might afford it, what the proper balance of private and public investment is, how we should recruit more people because there's a massive staffing crisis, how they should be remunerated. There's huge complexity there, but as a core national issue where people's hearts are, they don't get bogged down in all that complexity. Whereas with housing, of course there's complexity. The issue is, though, people need to feel like it's something that there's a right to a safe home, just like there's a right to healthcare, and that that right should be defended. And then it's up to the politicians to make that work policy-wise, because they know if they don't make it work policy-wise, it's a vote loser. They do know that with health and they don't with housing. And I think that's the problem. So you're absolutely right. Of course, there's a lot of complexity and the policy answers to this are relatively complex. But my biggest worry isn't that. If there was the political imperative, that would be sorted. The problem is that we need to get the political imperative up there.
How can social science help? I mean, this is the Academy of Social Sciences
yes.
podcast. You're a fellow. I'm president. Explore that for just a few seconds.
I guess what I feel is that we need housing to be something that people really devote time, research skills, communication skills to getting housing out there as a really significant, important issue. And that's where I feel social science helps, to provide the evidence to make that case and to make that evidence accessible and understandable for people. And I also think what we most need, really, is people with a voice and with credibility and authority to be arguing the case. Not so much the policy case, but the case for the impact that the housing crisis is having on people's lives. So that's social science
that's
as
social
well.
Science. That's where social science. That's where
social
science. Social really, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So what does it mean? So when people are experiencing poor housing, what is the impact of that on their lives? And how are we suffering as a country because we're wasting people's potential purely because of where they have to live, not because of anything about them, but because of where they have to live? And that's something I feel like social science can really bring to life and demonstrate. Why is a safe home so essential? We all know it is, but let's let's really delve into that and talk about it.
Con, I'm going to round this up, but I want to give you a chance to kind of rouse us. A rousing last two or three sentences from you, Polly. Make us care, a call to action, whatever it is you feel that you kind of able to say at the end of this. Come on.
I suppose what I would want to say is we are now in an intolerable, appalling housing emergency, and the human cost is incalculable. I would say to social scientists, help us show that human cost. And I would say as well, this is an emergency that has a solution. We can solve this. It doesn't require, you know, huge multinational agreements to solve like climate change does. Not that that isn't important. This is something we can solve as a country. We just have to want to.
Pauline, thank you very much. That's been a tour of the horizon. We've done everything really there, from the impact on our civilization to the birth rate to social housing to the growth of rough sleeping, all of which roots back to, you know, crazed land values and a lack of will to address it. And you've kind of put a clarion call out, not just to social scientists, but to the political class and to voters at the next general election, that actually this should be right up there. It's one of the kind of top half dozen issues, if not higher, that they should vote on and should confront the country. And as you've repeatedly said, it's soluble.
Absolutely.
That's your big message. We can do this.
We can do this. We just have to want to. Thank you so much for having me.
Great. A great pleasure. So, Pauline, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining in the conversation. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends, or send us an email and tell us what we should be asking and who we should talk to.